Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday, January 12th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19. Omicron may be headed for a drop by Maria Chang and Carla Johnson, the Associated Press. King Soopers, No Deal and Labor Dispute by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. And 12 Tribes Compound, Firefighters Called to Legal Trash Blaze Days Before Marshall Fire by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. King Soopers, No Deal and Labor Dispute. Workers Union Rejects Company's Last Best Offer Strike Plan for Wednesday Morning by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. As King Soopers union members prepared to strike across the metro area, the company offered on Tuesday what it called its final offer, boosting its proposal on wages and bonuses by $22 million. The $170 million package includes wage increases of up to $4.50 an hour in the first year based on job classification and tenure. Additional raises over the life of the contract and bonuses ranging from $2,000 to $4,000 for ratification of the contract. The United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7 rejected the company's latest proposal Tuesday, what King Soopers called its last best offer, after also spurning a $148 million offer last week, the last time the two sides met at the bargaining table. The union has called for a three-week strike starting at 5 a.m. Wednesday in the Denver area. Boulder and Parker, the sites of the stores where the contracts with King Soopers have expired. The strike, being waged on claims of unfair labor practices, will involve about 8,400 workers and 68 stores. We strike because it has become clear this is the only way to get what is fair, just, and equitable for the grocery workers who have risked their lives every day just by showing up to work during the pandemic, Cordova said in a statement. Cordova said the company still hasn't given the union information on wages, bonuses, pensions, and other items that it needs to evaluate the latest proposal. The labor dispute began heating up in late December, with the UFCW Local 7 filing a lawsuit in federal court that accuses Colorado's largest grocer chain of unfair labor practices. King Soopers responded Monday with a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board accusing the union of the same thing. The union on Monday rejected a suggestion by King Soopers to call in a federal mediator, saying involving a third party would bog down the process. The feedback King Soopers is getting is that a majority of the employees want to vote on the company's proposal, said Joe Kelly, president of King Soopers and City Market. Unfortunately, they're not being given that opportunity. But we continue to reach out to Kim and her team to see if we can get this vote scheduled, Kelly said. Once again, she's not replying to us. The strike will affect the King Soopers stores in the following cities: Denver, Arvada, Aurora, Boulder, Broomfield, Centennial, Commerce City, Edgewater, Inglewood, Evergreen, Federal Heights, Glendale, Golden, Greenwood Village, Highlands Ranch, Lakewood, Littleton, Louisville, Thornton, Westminster, and Wheat Ridge. The union's contracts with other King Soopers and City Market stores, both owned by Kroger, expire later in January and in February. The union is still negotiating with Albertsons, which owns Albertsons and Safeway stores in the state. King Soopers and the union have been gearing up for employees walking off the job. Employees in the Denver area, Boulder, Parker, and Colorado Springs, voted last week to authorize the strike. Employees in Colorado Springs are staying on the job for now because the meat workers' contract hasn't run out yet. The UFCW Local 7 said it expects union members from across the country to come to Colorado to support the striking workers. Meanwhile, King Soopers has been advertising for replacement workers at $18 an hour. The union has said the pay is higher than what would many regular employees make. The company said the average pay in Colorado is $18.29. This is what happens at this point when they can't find common ground to reach an agreement. Both sides start getting more polarized, said Cindy Fukami, a professor of management at Daniels College of Business at the University of Denver. While there have been last-minute efforts, such as calling for federal mediation, Fukami said it's almost like fiddling while Rome burns. Partly it's trying to get public opinion on one side or the other, but it doesn't help to resolve the issues that are causing this, Fukami said. Cordova said the union is willing to return to the bargaining table, but it needs more data from King Soopers. The only offer on the table is ours. The bargaining committee rejected the company's offer last week, Cordova said. They've been telling members in the community and the media they want workers to vote on an offer that's already been rejected. The union says King Soopers proposals are full of concessions they want from employees at a time when they are still working during a pandemic. One of the proposals criticized by the union would cap sick leave at 48 hours a year. Wages, staffing, the outsourcing of jobs, and health and safety concerns are also priorities, Cordova said. A majority of King Soopers employees are part-time, and the union wants to find a faster pathway to full-time job for those who want more hours, she added. A study commissioned by four branches of the UFCW and released Tuesday said that 78% of the employees surveyed at the Kroger-owned stores in Colorado and two other states reported not having enough food. That is more than seven times the national rate, said Peter Dreyer, a co-author of the study. That's particularly ironic and tragic because these are people who spend their whole day around food, said Dreyer, a professor of urban policy at Occidental College in Los Angeles. The survey also found that 44% of employees couldn't pay rent, and 14% of the part-time employees and 9% of the full-time employees were homeless or had been in the past year. The study, co-authored by Daniel Flaming, president of the nonprofit research firm Economic Roundtable, was based on responses from Kroger employees in the Puget Sound region of Washington, Colorado, and Southern California. About 28%, or 10,287 of the 36,795 workers contacted, responded. Kroger is doing well, Dreyer added. The study said the company's operating profits were $4.05 billion in 2020, and the company bought back $1.3 billion in stocks during that period. At the end of 2021, Kroger authorized a $1 billion buyback of stock. That was money that could have been spent on making workers' incomes more sustainable, Dreyer said. Kroger said in a statement that it invests hundreds of millions of dollars annually in its employees' wages, health care, retirement savings, and career opportunities. We are one of the largest employers in America, employing nearly 500,000 people, and our longstanding culture of opportunity has created an environment where many people, whether it be cashier, clerk, stocker, or pharmacy technician, come for a job and stay for a career, the company said. DU professor Fukami said the grocery business operates on tiny margins. She said competition from Walmart has been an issue for King Soopers for years. If you're Walmart, you have non-union workers and you're paying them very low wages, so you can undercut the prices more than the unionized grocery stores. Safeway's in the same boat, Fukami said. Because of widespread labor shortages, King Soopers employees have other options, said Fukami, adding that she wonders where the company will find enough replacement workers. That does suggest that the workers will have some power over the company just on the basic supply and demand of workers, she added. COVID-19. Omicron may be headed for a drop, by Maria Cheng and Carla Johnson, the Associated Press. Scientists are seeing signals that COVID-19's alarming Omicron wave may have peaked in Britain and is about to do the same in the U.S., at which point cases may start dropping off dramatically. The reason? The variant has proved so wildly contagious that it may already be running out of people to infect, just a month and a half after it was first detected in South Africa. It's going to come down as fast as it went up, said Ali Mokdad, a professor of health metric sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. At the same time, experts warn that much is still uncertain about how the next phase of the pandemic might unfold. The plateauing or ebbing in the two countries is not happening everywhere at the same time or at the same pace. And weeks or months of misery still lie ahead for patients and overwhelmed hospitals, even if the drop-off continues to pass. There are still a lot of people who will get infected as we descend the slope on the backside, said Lauren Ansel Myers, director of the University of Texas COVID-19 Modeling Consortium, which predicts that reported cases will peak within the week. The University of Washington's highly influential model projects that the number of daily reported cases in the U.S. will crest at 1.2 million by January 19th and will then fall sharply simply because everybody who could be infected will be infected, according to Mokdad. In fact, he said, by the university's complex calculations, the true number of new daily infections in the U.S., an estimate that includes people who were never tested, has already peaked, hitting 6 million on January 6th. In Britain, meanwhile, new COVID-19 cases dropped to about 140,000 a day in the last week, after skyrocketing to more than 200,000 a day earlier this month, according to government data. Kevin McConway, a retired professor of applied statistics at Britain's Open University, said that while cases are still rising in places such as Southwest England and the West Midlands, the outbreak may have peaked in London. The figures have raised hopes that the two countries are about to undergo something similar to what happened in South Africa, where in the span of about a month, the wave crested at record highs and then fell significantly. We are seeing a definite falling off of cases in the UK, but I'd like to see them fall much further before we know if what happened in South Africa will happen here, said Dr. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at Britain's University of East Anglia. Differences between Britain and South Africa, including Britain's older population and the tendency of its people to spend more time indoors in the winter, could mean a bumper outbreak for the country and other nations like it. On the other hand, British authorities' decision to adopt minimal restrictions against Omicron could enable the virus to rip through the population and run its course much faster than it might in Western European countries that have imposed tougher COVID-19 controls, such as France, Spain, and Italy. Shabir Madi, Dean of Health Sciences at South Africa's University of Witwatersrand, and said European countries that impose lockdowns won't necessarily come through the Omicron wave with fewer infections. The cases may be just spread out over a longer period of time. On Tuesday, the World Health Organization said there have been 7 million new COVID-19 cases across Europe in the past week, calling it a tidal wave sweeping across the region. WHO cited modeling with Mokdad's group that predicts half of Europe's population will be infected with Omicron within about 8 weeks. There will probably be some ups and downs along the way, but I would hope that by Easter we will be out of this, Hunter said. Still, the sheer numbers of people infected could prove overwhelming to fragile health systems, said Dr. Prabhat Jha of the Center of Global Health Resources at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. The next few weeks are going to be brutal because in absolute numbers, there are so many people being infected that will spill over into ICUs, Jha said. Mokdad likewise warned in the U.S. it's going to be a tough 2 or 3 weeks. We have to make hard decisions to let certain essential workers continue working, knowing they could be infectious. Omicron could one day be seen as a turning point in the pandemic, said Myers at the University of Texas. Immunity gained from all of the new infections, along with new drugs and continued vaccination, could render the coronavirus something with which we can more easily coexist. At the end of this wave, far more people will have been infected by some variant of COVID, Myers said. At some point, we'll be able to draw a line, and Omicron may be that point, where we transition from what is a catastrophic global threat to something that's a much more manageable disease. That's one plausible future, she said, but there is also the possibility of a new variant, one that is far worse than Omicron arising. 12 Tribes Compound. Firefighters called to legal trash blaze days before Marshall Fire, by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. Firefighters responded to a trash fire at the property that has been the focus of the Marshall Fire investigation six days before the fast-moving wildfire blazed a swath of destruction across Boulder County, according to a fire department report obtained by the Denver Post. At 11:53 a.m. on December 24th, a concerned passerby alerted authorities to a fire at 5325 Eldorado Springs Drive, a compound occupied by members of the 12 Tribes religious sect. A Mountain View fire rescue crew investigated the fire that day and left without extinguishing it because it was not illegal, the report shows. Claire Toney, the Eldorado Springs resident who reported the trash fire, said she told authorities she saw a large, unattended fire on the property and was concerned because of dry and windy conditions that day. The flames were tall, and I didn't see any human beings around, she said. The 12 Tribes compound is now under investigation as authorities try to pinpoint where the deadly December 30th wildfire began. Boulder County Sheriff's investigators fenced off the property and served a search warrant on the compound, where a witness's video on the day of the Marshall fire showed a shed burning. Investigators have not pinpointed the cause or start of the blaze, and it is unclear if the Marshall Fire began on the 12 Tribes compound. Boulder County Sheriff Joe Pelley said the wildfire started somewhere in the neighborhood, but he cautioned against jumping to conclusions. After the passerby's call on Christmas Eve, firefighters from Mountain View Fire Rescue arrived at the 12 Tribes compound to discover a man burning trash in a dirt field, according to a fire department report. The fire could be seen from the road, the report says. He stated that he would be burning railroad ties for the next few hours, the report reads. He also had a front-end loader and a water source established for control measures. The area was not under a burn ban or any wind warnings that day, according to the National Weather Service in Boulder. The 12 Tribes property sits off the east side of Colorado 93, just beyond the boundaries of a Boulder County fire ban, which covered the western half of the county and ended on the west side of Colorado 93, just across the road from the 12 Tribes property. Just 6 days after Tony reported the trash fire, she watched the beginnings of the Marshall Fire, she said. When I saw the fire, I realized what I was looking at was the exact location of where I saw the flames a week before, she said. The Marshall Fire destroyed more than 1,000 homes and burned across 6,000 acres in Superior, Louisville, and unincorporated Boulder County, driven east by hurricane-force winds. One man was killed and a woman remains missing. Dave Maggio, a five-year neighbor to the 12 Tribes property, told the Post 3 days after the Marshall Fire that the religious sect members burned regularly on the property and that fires had in the past gotten out of control. The Boulder County Sheriff's Office initially refused to make public any records about its visits to the 12 Tribes compound in the past, but has since reversed course. On Saturday, the Sheriff's Office released reports that showed deputies have been called to the property 7 times since 2014 for issues not related to fires or burning. Then, on Tuesday, the Sheriff's Office released a list of 30 calls for service at the compound between 2018 and December 29, 2021. That list includes calls for trespassing, medical problems, welfare checks, child issues, parking, and a noise complaint, as well as 12 calls about control burns. Control burn calls are made by property owners to alert authorities to planned fires. The sheriff's office said in a statement, most of the calls about control burns at the 12 tribes were made in the spring and early summer of 2020 by a man affiliated with the group, the records show. The call list also shows that a passerby called the authorities about a non-structure fire at the compound on April 2019. The response to that call was prioritized as an emergency, the records show. The records released by the sheriff's office do not include the passerby's call on Christmas Eve about the trash fire. Mountain View Fire Rescue Deputy Chief Jeff Webb said the incident was entered in dispatch records under the wrong address and confirmed Tuesday that firefighters responded to the 12 tribes compound. On the day of the Marshall Fire, Boulder County was under a high wind warning from the National Weather Service Agency meteorologist Greg Hansen said Tuesday. The area was not under a formal red flag warning, but in Boulder County, burning is prohibited whenever there is a high wind warning. The National Weather Service did not issue a red flag warning on December 30th because relative humidity did not fall low enough to qualify for that warning, Hansen said. Relative humidity must be at or below 15% for a red flag warning to be issued. On December 30th, it was between 20% and 30%, Hansen said. That humidity requirement might change in the wake of the Marshall Fire, Hansen said. We are starting to go back and look at that in and get in touch with our fire partners and make an allowance for extremely high wind, he said. That may be a change we make. Free rapid COVID-19 tests. Unprecedented demand leads to longer state waits, by Meg Wingert of the Denver Post. If you want free rapid COVID-19 testing kits, you're looking at a wait of 2 weeks or potentially longer right now due to high demand, according to Colorado Department of Health and Environment. When the state started offering the test to the general public in September, waits of 14 days or longer for the free kits to be shipped to people's homes were relatively common. Wait times dropped over the next few weeks as demand and supply came into balance, but started rising again in mid-December. Free tests can be ordered online at covid19.colorado.gov/covid-19testing-at-home. An unidentified spokeswoman for the state health department said orders started to spike around December 19th when cases were just starting to rise again. Before that time, the state received an average of about 3,000 orders a day, but now it can get as many as 20,000 in a day, she said. Between November 29th and January 2nd, the state shipped about 75,000 test kits to individuals. That's somewhat behind October when about 80,000 kits went out. The state has started working with Amazon to try to increase shipments to Coloradans, but a two-week wait time may remain the norm for a while, the spokeswoman said. States are competing with each other and with private employers who are counting on the test to help them determine who can safely work. There currently is unprecedented national demand for rapid at-home tests, and we are proud to be the first state in the nation to provide these tests for free to Coloradans, the health department said in a statement. To date, we have distributed more than 1.5 million tests to Coloradans. The free rapid tests are supposed to be used for screening, not for diagnosing yourself if you have symptoms. The idea is that if you test yourself twice a week, you may be able to identify an infection when you're at your most contagious. Rapid tests have given more false negatives with Omicron than they did with previous variants, but they rarely give false positives. If a rapid test says you have COVID-19, you should stay at home and take other precautions as if you do. If you have symptoms and need to know if COVID-19 is causing them, though, the best thing to do is to get a test that looks like the virus's genetic material. About 150 sites around the state offer them, though many people using those have also experienced delays. A Denver Post reader shared an email he received from the COVID Check Colorado advising anyone who hadn't received the results within 5 days to consider scheduling another test for an up-to-date answer on whether they have the virus. Current guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention allows people to leave quarantine 5 days after their symptoms begin if they don't have a fever and wear a mask around others. If tests take 5 days or longer to come back, people could be in the position of deciding whether to return to work without knowing what's causing any symptoms they may still have. While most transmission happens in the first days of an infection, some people can shed the virus for 10 days or longer. Joshua Posner, Senior Director of Operations for COVID Check Colorado, said in a statement that the group has seen unprecedented demand for tests. COVID Check operates 26 sites in the Denver area and 21 in other parts of the state. Last week, they performed about 65,000 tests, close to double the 35,000 tests they handled in a typical week before the Omicron surge, he said. Most patients still get results within 3 days, but some have had to wait up to 5 days, Posner said. We understand how challenging it can be for those waiting to receive test results, and in response to this lag, we diverted tests to even more partner labs in an effort to reduce the wait, he said. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Catherine Bell Bennett, May 13, 1934 to January 7, 2022. Catherine Bell Bennett, 87, was welcomed in the Kingdom of Heaven on January 7, 2022. Catherine was born in Littleton, Colorado on May 13, 1934 to parents Robert and Helen Weaver. Catherine was always known as a woman of strong faith in Jesus Christ. She loved Colorado, especially Littleton, the town she was born in and eventually passed away in. Catherine was preceded in death by her husband, Lee, her son, Daryl, and her grandson, Devin. She is survived by sons, Larry and Brian, daughters-in-law, Heather, Melissa, and Carol, grandchildren, Monica, Alexis, Tyler, Caitlin, Ellie, and Garrison, as well as great-grandchildren, Campbell, Madden, Sloan, Madeline, Vincent, Reese, and Remington. Due to current pandemic conditions, services will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to the American Cancer Society. Daniel Patrick Davis, September 27, 1943 to January 8, 2022. Daniel Patrick Davis was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. He grew up in Edina, Minnesota. He is survived by Sandy, his wife and best friend of 35 years. He is also survived by his children, Tom Davis, wife Bridget, a third-generation sales representative, and Jennifer Davis, husband Brad, an accomplished artist. His grandchildren, Tyler Davis and Emma Backlund. His siblings, John Davis, wife Jenny, Sally Fessler, husband John, Julie Davis, husband Rolf, plus nieces and nephews. He enjoyed playing all sports, but excelled in baseball as a catcher. He was proud of the fact that he was scouted by the Cincinnati Reds. After high school, he attended the University of Minnesota and then enlisted in the Army. He loved to play golf, read, watch old black and white movies and old westerns. His favorite saying lately was, "I could have been a cowboy." After moving to Fort Collins in 1991, Dan and Sandy started their own sales rep business and traveled 9 states selling Harley-Davidson licensed products to HD dealerships. They traveled together and he called it a dream job. After retirement, he loved their winters at their beach condo in San Jose del Cabo and summers at their cabin in the Colorado Mountains. Most everyone took a shine to Dan from the get-go. If you were with Dan, you knew you were going to have fun and laugh. He will always be loved and always be missed. Friends and family can share condolences at GOES, GOES, funeralcare.com. Pauline Domenico, September 23rd, 1923 to December 27th, 2021. Pauline passed away on December 27th, 2021 at the age of 98 at the assisted living facility in North Glen, where she lived for the past 9 years. Prior to that, she was a lifelong resident of Denver, Welby. Pauline grew up on her parents' truck farm, working on the farm while also going to school. She attended Assumption Elementary School and graduated from Assumption High School. She was a lifelong member of Assumption Catholic Church, where for many years she printed the Sunday Bulletin. Pauline's first job was at a fishing tackle company. She then moved to the Denver Post. Her final position was an executive secretary at Texaco. Pauline loved to work in her yard, bake Italian cookies, and take care of her house, which was spotless. She played bingo and belonged to several organizations at Assumption Church. Her piano was used for many years at Assumption. Pauline is survived by her brother Bernard and nephew David, who live in California. Visitation will be held on Thursday, January 13, 2022 at 4:30 p.m. with a rosary service at 6:30 p.m. at Horan M. Kennedy, 9998 Grant Street, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. Funeral Mass on Friday, January 14, 2022 at 11:30 a.m. at Assumption Catholic Parish, 2361 East 78th Avenue, Denver, followed by burial at Mount Olivet Cemetery at 1:30 p.m. Kenneth N. Greenlaw, Jr., October 8, 1931 to January 8, 2022. Kenneth N. Greenlaw, Jr., 90, of Highlands Ranch, formerly of Littleton, passed away January 8, 2022. Services will be held Monday, January 17, 2022, 10 a.m. at the Drink Wine Chapel. Please see full obit on our website. Ving Kiatukasi Lor, May 7, 1969 to December 24, 2021. Ving Lor, age 52, of St. Paul, Minnesota, previously Westminster, Colorado, passed away on December 24, 2021. Preceded in death by his father, Tua K. Lor, survived by his son, James, mother, Tong Lee, brothers, AC, Amy, Thomas, and Tony, and sisters, May, Mi, Shua, and May Yer. Ving is a lifelong resident of Westminster, Colorado. Attended and graduated from Westminster High School, class of 1988. He loved soccer, music, and a spirited debate. We will miss you. Funeral service information, January 15th, 2021, at honsafamilyfuneral.com. Linda Losasso, December 31st, 1953 to January 5th, 2022. Linda Paulette Losasso, 68, of Littleton, Colorado, passed away on January 5th, 2022. Linda was born on December 31st, 1953 in Aurora, Illinois, daughter to the late Paul and Dolores Gardner. Linda is survived by her husband Clyde Losasso, Sr., daughters Gianna Losasso and Francesca Losasso, and son Clyde Losasso Jr. Visitation will be held January 12, 2022 at 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Horan M. Kennedy, 3020 Federal Boulevard, Denver, Colorado, 80211. Funeral Mass will be held on Friday, January 14, 2022 at 10 a.m. at Mount Carmel Catholic Church, 3549 Navajo Street, Denver, 80211. Burial will follow at Mount Olivet. For full obituary, please see HoranCares.com. Earl Mitchell, November 18, 1939 to December 21, 2021. Earl Lewis Mitchell, 82, passed away at his home in Rimrock, Arizona on December 21, 2021. He lived most of his life in the Jeffco area until moving to Arizona in 1996. He was an avid car guy on pit crews and driving at Lakeside Speedway for many years. He was a longtime member of the Sabres of Denver Car Club. He is survived by his wife, 3 children, 7 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren. Elizabeth Betsy Shattuck, April 2, 1926 to January 7, 2022. Betsy was born April 2, 1926 in Denver, Colorado. She graduated from East High School, Denver, where she was a head girl of her senior class. She earned a scholarship to Colorado College, Colorado Springs, where she was a Kappa member. She married James Jim Shattuck, August 10, 1945, at Calvary Baptist Church, Denver. They were married for 70 years. She is survived by her 4 children, Jim Shattuck, wife Pam, Susan Cinnamon, husband Gary, and Steve Shattuck, wife Sarah, and Jeff Shattuck, wife Lori, and her sister, Pat Dalton of Long Beach, California. She had 9 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren. Betsy was a member of Chapter CZ-PEO and was also a member of Mountain View Methodist Church, Boulder. She has donated her body to Science Care, followed by cremation. There will be a private family service. She was preceded in death by her husband, her parents, her brother, Bob Reeves, and her daughter-in-law, Stacy Shattuck. Please consider a donation to one of her favorite charities, Boulder Humane Society or the Barbara Davis Center for Diabetes. Roger Simon. Roger L. Simon, age 88, passed away Monday, January 10, 2022. Preceded in death by his childhood sweetheart and wife of 63 years, Beverly Bevy Joyce Simon, and beloved son Mark Simon. He is survived by his children Cheryl, husband Frank McKett, and Michael Simon, grandchildren Andrew Simon and Amanda, husband Taylor Simon. Private services will be held at 11:45 a.m. Thursday, January 13th. Live stream on Feldman's Mortuary YouTube channel. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to the Denver Hospice or a charity of your choice. Roland G. Wimmer, November 26, 1924 to January 6, 2022. Roland Roley Galt Wimmer was a loving husband, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and friend. He passed away peacefully on January 6, 2022 at age 97. Roley was born to Elva G. and Roland H. Wimmer on November 26, 1924 in Pueblo, Colorado. After high school, he served 2 tours in the U.S. Army and then graduated from the University of Denver with a B.S. in Business Administration. In 1950, Roley married Marilyn Kenworthy Bell, also of Pueblo, and together they had 3 children, Kirk, wife Donna Leslie, Kent, wife Sue West, and Kay, now deceased, which they raised in Denver and Arvada. They now have 6 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. Roley retired from Mountain States Telephone after 29 years. He and Marilyn started a business based on their hobby of collecting antiques. They opened a cute shop in Arvada and also traveled around the country to sell their wares at antique shows. Roley was active in the Arvada Rotary Club, where he served as president in 1965 and was given Rotarian of the Year and Lifetime Service Awards. He and Marilyn raised their family in the United Methodist Church, which they supported generously with gifts and service. A private memorial service will be planned in the spring when travel is safer. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Ed Perlmutter's congressional seat. State Senator Brittany Peterson joins race for 7th Congressional District by John Aguilar of the Denver Post. Veteran state lawmaker and Democrat Brittany Peterson announced Tuesday that she will vie to replace Rep. Ed Perlmutter in the U.S. House, entering a race that slightly favors Democrats but could prove intriguingly competitive amid a bitter national political climate. "Getting good people elected to office is more urgent than ever," said the state senator from Lakewood, who served in the state House as well. "When I see threats to the very fabric of our democracy, the stakes couldn't be higher." Peterson, 40, is so far the most prominent Democrat to go after the 7th Congressional District seat that's been held by Perlmutter since 2007. He announced Monday that he plans to retire when his term ends in January 2023. In her 10 years serving in the state legislature, Peterson said several issues have risen for her as critical: mental health, gun safety, education, and opioid addiction. Her mother became wildly addicted to pain pills after hurting her back, and it took years to get her the treatment she needed. "It was through my life experiences that I saw how absolutely broken our behavioral services system is," Peterson said. "I have taken my story to fight for others." She is also proud of her work on getting Colorado's red flag gun bill passed in 2019. The controversial bill created a legal framework for judges to order the removal of firearms from people they determined to be at risk of harming themselves or others. "When I was a kid, we had fire drills," Peterson said. "My son is growing up with mass shooter drills, and that's unacceptable." Peterson is married to Ian Silveri, who writes an opinion column for the Denver Post. They have a one-year-old son. Peterson made a short-lived attempt to run for the 7th Congressional District in 2017 when Perlmutter turned his sights on the Colorado governor's office, but she and others abandoned their plans when Perlmutter dropped out of the governor's race and returned to his congressional seat. The dynamics in the 7th District favored Democrats by about 7%, according to the Colorado Redistricting Commission's analysis of recent past elections. "But the district will be different than what it is today under Perlmutter, as redistricting efforts have last year pulled its boundaries much further south and west to encompass parts of several conservative mountain counties like Chaffee, Fremont, and Custer. But the bulk of the district remains centered on population-rich Jefferson County, which has increasingly turned blue in recent election cycles. And it's been Peterson's home for her entire life. I will bring the same focus I have always brought, which is working on the issues that affect regular people," she said. There are no other announced Democrats in the race so far, and State Rep. Chris Kennedy told the Post that speculation about his entry into the race was misplaced. He is endorsing Peterson. So far, two Republicans, Eric Odland and Lauren Eimer, have announced their candidacies. GOP State Rep. Colin Larson told the Post this week that he would likely make a decision about a run for the seat in the next week. Marshall Fire. Boulder County Fund releases $3.8 million to help 1,400 people, families, by Kieran Nicholson, the Denver Post. The Boulder County Wildfire Fund has distributed $3.8 million to nearly 1,400 people and families directly impacted by the Marshall Fire. The funds released part of an initial $5 million in allocated assistance was announced Tuesday by the Community Foundation Boulder County. Community Foundation Boulder County wants to thank the over 57,000 individuals, foundations, and companies who have collectively donated nearly $19.5 million in support for our friends and neighbors, CEO Tatiana Hernandez said of the CFBC. "This unbelievable generosity and close collaboration with our county and state government partners has allowed us to distribute assistance immediately. We know money cannot replace all that was lost. We do hope, however, that this support gives people a small sense of stability as they navigate what comes next. A $150,000 grant to United policyholders to support anyone who needs help navigating their insurance policies has been approved, according to a news release. Representatives from United Policyholders are available at the Disaster Assistance Center, 1755 South Public Road, Lafayette. The DAC, which offers a variety of services to people impacted by the fire, is open from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. 7 days a week. It's brutal in there. This Denver restaurant opened two locations during the pandemic. One of them burned in the Marshall Fire, by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. Childhood friends Don Gregg and Scott and Brian Boyd have had one of their more surreal experiences running a Denver restaurant, their first together. The Rotary opened in 2018 at local food hall Avanti. For 18 months, it gained a local loyal following, and then the pandemic shut down all indoor dining. As seating returned but capacity restrictions lingered, Gregg and the Boyd brothers tried to weather COVID-19 alongside six other food stalls in their building. Then in January 2021, they finally opened the Rotary at its own brick-and-mortar location within a small business district on Holly Street in Hilltop. And nearly a year later, on December 15th, the team was excited to debut a second neighborhood location in Louisville. Just 15 days later, on December 30th, that restaurant was destroyed in the Marshall Fire. It was kind of the ideal situation to open up a place, Scott Boyd said, of the Rotary start 3 years ago inside a bustling food hall. We went from the ideal scenario to borderline the absolute worst. On Thursday, Boyd returned to his Louisville restaurant. It's brutal in there, Boyd said, describing the blown out windows and doors, burnt walls, burst pipes, waterlogged and now frozen surfaces, and smoke damage to what's left of the equipment. Still, he's thankful. We are insured, and we're insured for business loss, and our staff should be insured for up to 60 days. Not that that's long, but at least it's long enough to help people until they find something else. The Rotary was one of seven businesses destroyed in Louisville and Superior, and is just a small portion of the $500 million destruction that's currently estimated in the area. While there's no blueprint yet in place for cleaning up around 6,000 burned acres and rebuilding, Boyd said he's hopeful that the restaurant will reopen eventually, just maybe in a different location. We still have essentially a 10-year lease there, he explained. My guess is the damage is so severe that it's not going to be able to rebuild in time for that lease to remain relevant. I think the reopen in our minds is that we intend to reopen another location, ideally in Louisville. That is total speculation, he added. From my layman's view, the building looks done. Speculation aside, it will be weeks, at least, before businesses like Boyd's have more answers. As he and his co-owners assess the damage, they're trying to divert employees and resources to the remaining Rotary location in Denver. There, they've been serving a steady, growing customer base over the past year with comforting rotisserie chicken thighs and pork shoulders, plus side dishes, salads, seasonal vegetables, and meals for most dietary restrictions. It's a menu and a format that worked well pre-pandemic as a business model now, it might be even smarter. We want to make really good, healthy food that you can have in a fast, casual environment, Boyd said. I personally believe Gregg is a rare talent with the food that he puts together. And just seeing the core following that we built up, I'm not the only one who feels that way. This week, Boyd said, the Rotary in Denver has experienced a small uptick in business. He's happy for the support now and hopes to turn first-time visitors into lifelong customers. And the Rotary is still on track for growth, he promises. If people come in this week or next week or 3 weeks from now, we're elated, Boyd said. If you want to come in and sit down with family or friends and have a glass of wine or a beer and chat for a while, you can. If you want to go on our app and just click reorder for curbside, you can do that. We just want to be as flexible as possible. About the chef. After growing up in Denver, Don Gregg became an opening chef at some of the city's most quintessential restaurants. Barolo Grill and Mel's since closed. He moved on to work across the country and the world, from Chez Panisse in Berkeley to New York's Gramercy Tavern, and more recently as a personal chef in France. Greg brings a mix of his experiences to his Denver restaurant. The Rotary, which revolves around Brazilian charrusca grilled meats and vegetables and sauces. The restaurant is fast casual with an emphasis on healthful meal options. Surge of flight cancellations. Airlines blame Omicron storms. CEO, more than 4% of United employees have tested positive. By Niraj Chokshi, the New York Times company. In a single day over the holidays, nearly one-third of United Airlines employees called out sick at Newark Liberty International Airport, a major hub for the airline, the company's chief executive said Tuesday. That disclosure, which came in a memo to staff members, helps to explain the industry's recent struggles. Storms disrupted flights by delivering whipping winds, rains, and heavy snowfall at airports nationwide, and the fast-spreading Omicron virus variant compounded the havoc by sickening thousands of airline workers, leaving many travelers stranded and angry. Overall, about 3,000 United Airlines employees, more than 4% of its workforce, have recently tested positive for the coronavirus, the airline's chief executive, Scott Kirby, said in his memo. The vast majority are not working, and United is cutting its flight schedule to manage the shortage. Our frontline teams continue to put in a tremendous effort during what I know is an incredibly challenging and stressful time. The Omicron surge has put a strain on our operation, resulting in customer disruptions during a busy holiday season, he said. United's experience is not particularly extraordinary, and two other companies have canceled many more flights. All told, the industry has canceled more than 29,000 flights, or about 8% of all scheduled trips since December 25th, according to FlightAware, a data tracking service. Many airlines say the virus is at least partly to blame. The problems began to mount in the days before Christmas. That week, several top Delta Airlines executives sent a letter to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention asking it to shorten the isolation time for fully vaccinated people infected by the virus, warning that the agency's recommendation of 10 days would leave the airline without enough workers during a crucial period. Similar to healthcare, police, fire, and public transportation workforces, the Omicron surge may exacerbate shortages and create significant disruptions, the executives, including Delta's CEO Ed Bastian, wrote in a December 21st letter. Cancellations started to mount later that week, topping 1,000 each day from the day after Christmas when heavy storms and bitter cold wreaked havoc on the Pacific Northwest. Through December 31st. During that period, JetBlue executives told employees in a memo that the airline had received record-breaking sick calls. On December 27th, partly as a result of requests like the ones made by Delta Airlines, as well as some public health experts, the CDC shortened its recommended isolation time for people who have been fully vaccinated to 5 days. But the change in health guidance would not give airlines much relief, at least not right away. The weather and the flight cancellations continue to get worse, peaking January 3rd when airlines canceled more than 3,100 flights, or about 13% of all scheduled trips. It wasn't until Monday that the number of daily flight cancellations fell below 1,000. In recent days, airlines have canceled many flights proactively to get a better handle on their operations and avoid surprising customers with last-minute changes. Thank you for joining us for the January 12th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.